Our next speaker is another outstanding champion of equal rights. And she's not afraid of taking on the biggest of the corporations or government bad actors to address injustice. She also happens to be a blind woman, simply striving to live the life she wants. She graduated with honors from Georgetown Law in 2007 and has, in a very short time, made a difference. She's a member of the bar in New York, California, and the District of Columbia, as well as several federal district courts, the United States Supreme Court, and several courts of appeal. Most recently, she was the co-director for the Access to Justice Project at Public Justice, where she worked for nearly a decade. Her work, and this will resonate with Federation members, her work is described as focusing on dismantling structural barriers that make it more difficult for people harmed by corporations or governments, government abuse, to use the civil courts to redress those injustices and get change. In May of 2022, she won a significant victory in a fight against forced arbitration in a case that she argued before the United States Supreme Court. I am not aware of another blind attorney who has argued and won a case in front of the Supreme Court, so she has done her work in a way that has set precedent in a very motivating way. She's worked closely on a number of federation matters, but most recently her leadership, she led the arguments in the Court of Appeals on behalf of Joe Orozco, which we discussed in the presidential report. I could talk for a long time about the many achievements that she's made in what is still a quite young career. I do want you to know, however, that she has been nominated by the President of the United States to serve as the General Counsel for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And this is a nomination that the Federation has enthusiastically supported. I just went over to her and asked if she was confirmed yet. She said, not yet. So we'll see at the end if you all still agree she should be confirmed by the Senate. I should also share with you that it's not just her tremendous work in the legal field. She is described as an avid baseball fan, a fantasy baseball nerd, and she enjoys hiking, cycling, and goalball. Maybe she can give me some pointers on throwing the first pitch in a couple days. Here's a true champion for equal rights and equal responsibility who's driven by her lived experience. Here's Carla Gilbride.
Good morning, everyone. And thank you to President Riccobono for inviting me here to speak with you all today. As a young child, I was convinced that I wanted to be a lawyer. Now, mind you, I didn't have a very good idea what it was that lawyers did, but I knew that I loved words, and I loved using words to get my way. My dad used to make a joke about this. He would say, "She's going to be a great lawyer someday because the judge will be so tired of hearing her argue that they'll let her win just to shut her up." But even though my aspirations to being a lawyer went all the way back to childhood, I couldn't have imagined as a law student, I couldn't have imagined as recently as 3 years ago, that I would have the opportunity to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. As I'll talk about a little bit later, making an argument there is very rare. Most lawyers never get the chance to do it, and I'm not aware of a totally blind lawyer who's ever argued there before. I did so last year. So, in thinking about in preparing to speak to you all about that experience, I had occasion to reflect on what brought me to that juncture and what traits and tools made it possible for me to seize that opportunity when it came my way. And I decided it boiled down to three things. I have a stubborn streak, I have strong blindness skills, and I have a passion to fight against injustice. So, going back to the stubborn streak, that also dates back to early childhood. And when I was young, it was really nothing more complex than that rebellious instinct a lot of little kids have to do the opposite of whatever the adults around them tell them to do. And as a general matter, I wouldn't recommend that, because usually the adults in our lives are telling us things that are good for us. But I've been totally blind since I was 2 years old. And many of us in the room who were blind as children may have had similar experiences to me, that sometimes the adults around you are telling you things that are not good for your development, such as, "Oh, you can just skip that assignment. It would probably be too hard for you anyway." Or, "Oh, it would be dangerous for you to do that phys ed activity. Why don't you just go sit on the sidelines and we'll get to you later?" And when the adults in my life said those kinds of things to me, my stubborn streak flared up, and I wanted to find a way to do the things they said I couldn't or shouldn't do. Or, as the child me would have put it, "Oh yeah, I'll show you." And fortunately for me, I had parents who were fierce advocates, and if they ever witnessed or heard from me about these sorts of incidents, they made clear to that gym teacher or that extracurricular activity leader that low expectations were not acceptable and that I would be included in whatever the other kids were doing. And I was fortunate that the administration in my public school also provided me with the supports and services that I needed. Another thing I'm very grateful to my parents for was that they exposed me to a lot of positive, successful adult blind role models, including members of the National Federation of the Blind. And those blind adults impressed upon me the importance of gaining a strong foundation in blindness skills like Braille and technology. And I had the good sense to listen to what those adults told me. So I became a proficient Braille user. I learned to use the computer and the internet early in my educational career. And so with those skills in hand, I went off to college after receiving a scholarship from the NFB in 1998. And when I came to the National Convention to receive that scholarship, I also had the opportunity to observe a mock trial and watch blind lawyers like Scott LaBarre in action. And that just reinforced for me that this club of blind lawyers was one I definitely wanted to belong to. So throughout college and law school, as I gained more experience, I was also exposed to many people from different backgrounds and different life experiences than my own and with different disabilities. And through getting to know those people and learning more about their stories, I gained a more sophisticated understanding of the different identities that we all carry and the different forms of discrimination that we all face. And I also came to appreciate that growing up as a white person in an affluent town on Long Island in a well-funded school district had afforded me a lot of advantages that many of my peers hadn't had, and that the history of injustice and access to opportunity in this country is far more complicated and far more painful than just my gym teacher telling me to sit on the sidelines. But even as my understanding of discrimination deepened and became more expansive, I never forgot what it felt like viscerally to be held apart, to be treated as less than others. And as I became a practicing lawyer, I would tap into those personal experiences and the feelings that they evoked in me, and that they still evoke in me when I experience discrimination to this day. For example, when I'm denied service from a rideshare driver with my guide dog, which happens all the time. And so I would tap into those experiences and those feelings to help me better relate to my clients who had experienced different but equally unjust mistreatment, whether it was being sexually harassed by a coworker or being passed over for promotion because they were black. That ability to empathize and have solidarity with others who experience mistreatment has made me a better lawyer. It's fueled my passion to fight against injustice. Because I do agree with what Dr. King said in his letter from a Birmingham jail, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And because I hold that belief, after I had spent 3 years working as a lawyer at Disability Rights Advocates in Berkeley, California, working on disability discrimination cases, I decided to move back east, where my family is from, and to take a job at a law firm in DC that handles all sorts of employment and housing discrimination cases. And ever since 2011, I've been practicing law in D.C., either at plaintiff's firms or public interest organizations, with a focus on workers' rights, both for discrimination and for people who are not being paid properly for their work. And so that workers' rights practice eventually led me in 2021 to meet Robin Morgan. And Robin was working at a Taco Bell franchise in Iowa. And she realized that she and her coworkers were not being paid overtime as the law requires when they worked more than 40 hours in a week. And so she filed a lawsuit on behalf of herself and her coworkers. And initially, she was successful. But on appeal, the decision was reversed. And this had to do with some complex legal stuff I'm not getting into involving forced arbitration. It said she couldn't be in court at all. She needed to go to a private arbitrator. The lawyers who had handled her case in the district court came to Public Justice, which is where I was working at the time. We have a lot of experience at Public Justice working on these issues. And they said, you know, the only step left for Robin's case, because we lost to the Court of Appeals, is to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'd like you to handle the case. And my boss at Public Justice said, well, Carla, you have a lot of experience working on these particular legal issues. So if we handle if we decide to go forward in the Supreme Court, I think you should handle the case. Yeah. And so I sat there for a minute, and there's a little voice inside my head said, whoa. Now I know the law in this area. I think we have a good chance of winning. But it's the Supreme Court. And as I said before, not a lot of people ever get a chance to argue there. They only take about 80 cases a year. And those 80 cases tend to be handled by a very few repeat player Supreme Court advocates who appear there over and over again. But my passion to fight against injustice prevailed over my doubts, and I thought that, you know, what had happened to Robin wasn't right. There was something that we could do about it. And so I said, yes, let's take the case. And so we filed our petition. Now, the Supreme Court didn't have to take it, but a couple months later, we found out that they had taken it, and we were off to the races. And that was in November of 2021. And then a few weeks after that, I found out that Taco Bell had hired to argue the case on their side one of those repeat player Supreme Court advocates who has been up there over and over again. For those who know the law, you might know his name. His name is Paul Clement. And at that time, he had argued over 100 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. And so at that point, that little voice inside my head that had said, whoa, it got a little bit louder. And it got some company, and there were a lot of little voices suddenly asking a lot of questions. What if you're not ready for this? What if you're not smart enough? What if you can't think on your feet as well as someone who's argued up there 100 times? And then it took a really toxic turn. These other thoughts came to the forefront. What if you go up there on this big stage and it doesn't go well, and people think, well, after all, what do you expect? She's blind. Luckily, just as that spiral of self-doubt was starting to take hold, that old stubborn streak flared up again. And it had something to say to all of those nagging negative thoughts swirling around my head. It said, oh yeah, I'll show you. And so I buckled down and I got back to preparing the case. And that preparation meant reading lots and lots of previous cases, which I did using JAWS. That preparation also involved listening to lots and lots of archival audio of past Supreme Court arguments. Luckily, Paul Clement had a large body of work, so I had a lot I could listen to. And the other thing, you know, that was helpful and that why I wanted to listen to all of these arguments was to try to memorize the voices of the different justices, since each of them has their own legal philosophy and way of approaching cases. It was very instructive for me to know who was asking me a question so that I could know how best to respond to it. Another thing I did to prepare was I put together a list of the most important cases and quotes that I wanted to have literally at my fingertips at the lectern that I could refer to in Braille as I was making my argument or as I was responding to questions. And having two or three pages of Braille notes is something that I've been doing, making a common practice whenever I do a court argument, whether a trial or appellate court. But a new thing that I hadn't done in every argument before, but that I wanted to be able to do at the Supreme Court argument, was to have a way of taking notes when Mr. Clement was arguing. Since we were the petitioner, we would go first. We had brought the case to the court, so we would go first. Then Mr. Clement would have his argument time, and I would get the last word in rebuttal. And so I wanted to have a reliable way of taking notes so that I could make that rebuttal. And I thought about bringing up a Braille display, but then I was worried, you know, what if the technology fails at a really inopportune moment? So I dug back into my old bag of tricks from blindness skills I hadn't really worked on since high school. And I brushed up on my slate and stylus skills. So a couple of weeks before the argument was scheduled, I called the Supreme Court to let them know I was bringing this slate and stylus into the building. I figured they wouldn't really know what it was, and I didn't want to get a problem with security. And I also asked them what accommodation they could make for their clock, which has a couple of different lights that come on, a yellow light when you have a couple minutes left, and then a red light when you're out of time. And I asked them, could they provide some sort of an audible tone? Did they have a non-visual component to their system for people who are arguing who can't see those colored lights? And they said, we haven't thought about that. This hasn't come up before, but we'll come up with something. And they did. They did come up with something. What they did was they had a court employee sit at a table and physically ring a bell when the light came on for yellow, when the light came on for red. So the day of the argument came, and it really went by in a blur. It lasted about an hour, but it felt much shorter than that because of all the adrenaline that was coursing through my veins. But it was actually surprisingly enjoyable to sort of be engaging, going back and forth with the justices. And before I knew it, the bell rang, and it was time to sit down. And I just sort of sat there in disbelief, thinking, did I just really do that? One thing that was strange about the argument, because of the COVID protocols that were in place at the time in early 2022, there was no public admitted into the court. So it was just the lawyers, the justices, and a very few court staff. One of the people who was there was the official court sketch artist, who draws pictures of the people arguing each case. And those sketches, because photographs aren't allowed in the court, those sketches are what will accompany any media account or article that's ever published about the case later. And I was so proud and so moved that the day after my argument, the official sketch appeared, which showed me standing at the lectern speaking with my hands on my Braille notes. And a handy little explanatory caption arrow pointing to my fingers with a note reading Braille. And so now, in the official archives of the Supreme Court, there will always be that documentation. That in March of 2022, a blind person argued at the Supreme Court and they used Braille to do it. Nice. And as proud as I am of that, I was equally proud 2 months later in May when, in a unanimous 9-0 opinion, the court ruled for Robin Morgan. And I was able to do my part to help her get the justice that she deserves. But as proud as I am of all of that, I will be even more proud when I get to hear the next blind lawyer argue a case at the U.S. Supreme Court. And what I really hope is that after 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 blind lawyers walk that path, the Supreme Court will decide to invest in some technological solution like a tone or a tactile buzzer for their visible light system, because they realize there are so many of us blind people arguing that just having a person ring the bell each time is not a good solution. But this isn't just a story about the Supreme Court, and I'm certainly didn't say yes to coming here today to speak to you just to congratulate myself and say, yay me, I did a good thing. I came here and I'm sharing this story with you because I know that many, if not all of you, will in the future experience a situation where you will have voices of self-doubt inside your head, like the ones that I described earlier. And sometimes those voices aren't just coming from inside our heads. Sometimes they're coming from out there in the world telling us, we shouldn't do this, we can't do that. No blind person has ever done this before, so what makes you think you can be the first? And when those voices come into your lives, whether they're external or internal or both, I hope that by sharing my story with you today, I will have given more strength and more conviction and more force to your own voice when you are able to answer back, oh yeah, I'll show you. Because we can all do more than other people think we're capable of. We can all do more than we often believe ourselves that we're capable of. And we can do even more when we support and lift up one another. And that spirit of mutual support and solidarity is one of the things that I admire most about this organization, especially when it's directed to those who are newly blind or to the next generation coming up. I am so grateful to everyone who has supported and encouraged me along my journey, including people who are here in the room today and others who are no longer with us. And I am honored to do what I can to pay it forward in the years ahead. Thank you all so much.
All right, don't go away, don't go away. Great job. Great
Thank
job.
You.
Step in front of the mic here. Now, I'd like to do something just in case members of the United States Senate are listening. Now that you've heard her presentation, all those in favor of her confirmation by the United States Senate say aye. Opposed say no. There you go, Congress. Get it done.
Great work.
Thank you.